be prepared. All right, thank you.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You can hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
Hello everyone, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. Today on American Indian Airwaves, we'll speak with a leading indigenous environmental scientist and activist on his brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, as we go to the east coast of Turtle Island. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone Makani blows to the Bahu drum. It's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
Today on American Indian Airwaves, we go to the east side of Turtle Island as we speak with a longtime community activist and citizen of the Lumbee Nation, Dr. Ryan Emanuel, who's also associate professor of hydrology at Duke University. He's the author of a brand new book titled On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. In the book, he shares stories from North Carolina about indigenous survival and resilience in the face of radical environmental changes. He addresses a wide range of issues, from the loss of wetlands to the arrival of the extractive industry, particularly the gas pipelines, and more. And now, Dr. Ryan Emanuel on the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. In reading the book and just understanding, you know, who you are and why the story is so important, or the stories that you tell in the book are so important, and how they are interwoven, wove together and entwined together, that you start in the beginning of the book with the fall line in Prospect, and you end in the, at the end of the book in Prospect. And, you know, so much about Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations and our traditional cultural practices and even contemporary cultural practices are, is rooted in this idea of place. And that's what I get, you know, in reading the book. So I was wondering, maybe we can start with the idea of place and how that relates to the beginning and the end of the book as part of telling your story on your journey.
Yeah, thanks for that, Larry. This book is all about place. And I start and end with Prospect, because that is a, that's a fixed point in the constellation of communities that kind of make up the Lumbee universe. Prospect is one of our oldest continuously inhabited communities. There are archaeological sites there going back many centuries, and then of course we've got a modern history, a written history that goes back well over a century there, if not two centuries, in Prospect. And so I started and ended the book in Prospect to give people a deeper sense of what it means to be rooted to a specific place, not just as an individual person, but as a collective. You know, my family doesn't come from Prospect, but as a Lumbee person, I have a deep regard for Prospect as a central place for Lumbee culture, Lumbee history, and all of the great things that, that make us a unique people.
In the book, you expand upon, you know, Lumbee history and the notion of place, but and the living histories of various places, not just for Lumbees, but for other Indigenous peoples. And, you know, for our listeners, you know, they can read in detail about that in the book, but give our listeners a sense of, you know, what is home for Lumbees and some of the other Indigenous nations that are, you know, referenced in the books, such as the Koharri people. There's a whole chapter on who the Koharris are in your direct relationship with them in numerous ways, but also Waccamaw Suan peoples and Skidade or Tuscarora peoples and other Indigenous peoples within people know as the state of North Carolina.
Yeah, well, North Carolina and Eastern North Carolina in particular aren't often thought of as part of Indian country, but in truth, you know, they are. We've got very large indigenous populations in that region. We come from different communities, but we share a history of being first contact peoples. And so we have this common rooting in what it means to experience this kind of colonial oppression that goes back many centuries. And I think that people who come from outside the Southeast or outside of North Carolina are going to be interested in this, because this is a perspective that isn't often shared in conversations about environmental justice and indigenous peoples. You know, we often rightly think about conflicts in other parts of the world, or maybe in the Western United States, or these other places, but the Southeast is not typically one of those places that, that first comes to mind when you think about indigenous peoples and their struggles to protect and preserve their relationships to place, and to achieve a measure of justice when it comes to the distribution of environmental burdens and environmental benefits, and also the ability to participate in decision-making about the places that they call home. So I wanted to shine a really bright and detailed light on present-day Eastern North Carolina as a really important and distinct and powerful place in these stories about environmental justice and indigenous peoples.
When you talk about environmental justice, and you know, if we look at the legacy, the Southern colonial legacy of conservation and environmental justice movements, you know, a lot of that came out of, you know, middle class white America, and even, you know, the creation of the Park Service can be traced back to having influence from the eugenicist movement, people like Madison Grant, the passing of the Great Race, and, you know, David Thoreau, and other kind of literary environmental writers of that time, and even Theodore Roosevelt and the creation of the National Park Service. So there's a certain, you know, kind of history to conservation and environmental justice. And I was wondering, what does that mean for indigenous peoples and, you know, in general, or for indigenous peoples, you know, like yourself and the work that you've done over the years, along with other indigenous peoples throughout the regions and other allies?
Yeah, that's a great question. To start out with, let's be clear, you know, these movements, conservation and environmentalism, were not created with indigenous peoples in mind, right? Just as you said. However, there's a potential today in the 21st century for these organizations and movements to be allies and to be partners in advancing the kind of work that puts indigenous perspectives and indigenous value systems at the forefront of thinking about how do we restore right relationships with the environment or and places that we come from. And so, you know, while I fully acknowledge the colonial underpinnings of these movements, I am also hopeful, based on my own experiences and based on other things that are happening out in the world, that these movements can actually help to advance the priorities and the values of indigenous peoples.
Now, in the book, you have a chapter. It's titled Water in the Lumbee World, Refugia Transformed. And I also know, you know, in terms of your own academic work, you're a hydrologist, and but also culturally, you know, for Lumbees and just all indigenous peoples, you know, water is sacred, and water is, you know, a source of life, and water is an intricate relationship for so many indigenous peoples back home. And I was wondering, maybe talk about water relations and in the context of your book, and how that helps set the stage further, if you will, to talk about some of these environmental struggles in defending home and working with other indigenous peoples and allies to protect Mother Earth in what is now called North Carolina.
Yeah, so, you know, we can think about water in at least two different ways, and these are two common ways of thinking about water and its importance. First of all, of course, it's an essential substance for life. But another way to think about water, and the way that it features most prominently in my book, is that, you know, water is a place. And for Lumbee people and for our indigenous neighbors in the Southeast, that place takes the form of wetlands, swamps, estuarine coastlines, marshes. These landscapes that are dominated by water are really important geographies in our communities. They define our histories, as I talk about in the book, how wetlands and swamps really shape the history of Lumbee people as a nation. And so while water is, you know, super important as a source of life, we also have to think about it in terms of it being a place. And this is a really hard thing to to get across in many of our conversations about environmental quality and pollution and permitting, because in these venues, we often think about water as a commodity, clean water for drinking, clean water for aquatic organisms. And yes, these things are incredibly important, but we don't always have conversations about water as a place and protecting the, these places that are defined by waterscapes and wetlands and things like this. So I think it's incredibly important to move our conversation towards water as a as an integral part of a cultural landscape, while we continue to talk about it as, you know, an important source of sustenance, habitat, and things like this.
You mentioned habitat, and so that leads to the question I always like to ask when talking with Indigenous peoples is, a lot of times, you know, people tend to be or can be very human-centric, and so in talking about water as a place or places and as a relationship, that sustains other places and relationships. So I was wondering, give our listeners a sense, and you touch on this in the book in various ways, of the interconnectedness of the relationship between water and other plant and animal relations. And you mentioned the book, like the scud fish, right, for example, out of the rivers. I always think of the holly plants in our conversations with Yupon, but, you know, sassafras, loblolly pine, all those things rely on the water system. And, you know, it's low tide lands, high alkaline, and I don't want to be too scientific, but, you know, it's a intricate web of life. And I just think that's so important to talk about those other relations, because when we start talking about, you know, or introduce readers to, you know, the struggle and the work that you did with ACP, right, the CAFA industries and the hurricanes, right, like they all have devastating implications for water, and then by relational connection, right, all these other relations.
Yeah.
So it's like the old, what is it, the old IWW slogan, an injury to one is a injury to all.
That's certainly true. And
we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Ryan Emanuel on his brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice in the East Side of Turtle Island in North Carolina. And now back to the interview.
So I think what I want to say about that is that coastal plain of what is now North Carolina is actually a hotspot for biodiversity. Mm. And most people don't think about our coastal plain as a biodiversity hotspot, because we tend to only see things like monoculture crop fields, corn, soybeans, cotton, maybe a generation ago, tobacco, really prominent on the landscape. But what people forget is that wetlands make up a large amount of the coastal plain landscape. And it's really the wetlands and the ecotones between the uplands and the wetlands that contain a lot of biodiversity in both plants and animal species. And so that's where we find a lot of our culturally important plants. The bald cypress, which is just this beautiful wetland tree with rot-resistant wood and, you know, amazing needles that turn brown and fall off every fall. It's where we find some of our food plants and medicine plants. And it's also where traditionally our animal relatives live and travel, right? These wetlands and the streams that flow through them were corridors for migratory fish. We out on the West Coast, you have Indigenous peoples who are very closely tied to salmon, And at one time, our people were closely tied to fish like sturgeon. And you know, we waited for the sturgeon migrations each year in much the same way that indigenous peoples in the West and in the Northwest rely on annual salmon runs. We don't have that anymore, right? Our sturgeon populations were eradicated more than a century ago. Wow. And that's something that I really lament. You know, the ability to continue those traditions, we just don't have that anymore. But it's important that people remember that the coastal plain really is this beautiful biodiverse place, and it's not just an assemblage of crop fields and farms, or a place to dispose of our animal waste, or a place to lay fossil fuel pipelines. It's not a waste place, and I regret that there's a long history of associating swamps with wastelands, right? That's a colonial idea, and it undermines the beauty and the cultural importance of swamps and other kinds of wetlands that we find all throughout the coastal plain.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Ryan Emanuel of the Lumbee Nation. He's also associate professor of hydrology at Duke University. He has authored a brand new book on the swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, and it's a compendium of different stories of his personal and professional experiences in working with Indigenous peoples and allies throughout what is now called the state of North Carolina. We want to remind listeners that the work that we do here on American Indian Airwaves and KPFK does require your support, and we're asking listeners during our fund drive to financially support KPFK to help us continue to bring diversified, wide range, and unheard Indigenous voices, to appreciate the work that all of us do here as volunteer programmers, as volunteer staff here at KPFK. We're asking you to financially support the station, and there's a variety of ways in which you can do that. You can visit the kpfk.org website, click on the KPFK Fund Drive widget. You can agree to donate a dollar amount of your choice. You can agree to become a KPFK Sustainer Circle member by agreeing to donate a dollar amount on a monthly basis. Or there's a list of premium items for a specific dollar amount as a way to say thank you. You can pick up one of those premium items for the dollar amount listed on the kpfk.org website as a way to support the station. You can call 818-985-KPFK, 818-985-5735. If you appreciate what we do here on American Indian Airwaves and all the volunteer programmers, all the volunteer staff in bringing you these invaluable stories and experiences of grassroots people, of activists in fighting against forms of injustice, we ask that you support KPFK. Without you, the listeners, KPFK cannot continue, and therefore we ask that you financially help us here on American Indian Airwaves. Help us here at KPFK. Show your appreciation. Donate a dollar amount. Again, visit the kpfk.org website. Click on the KPFK Fund Drive widget. Donate. Donate a dollar amount on a monthly basis. Look at the premium items. Pick up a premium item of your choice as a way to say thank you. And now we want to go back to our interview with Dr. Ryan Emanuel on his brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, here on American Indian Airwaves. Kind of like some of Indigenous nations whose maybe traditional homelands are out in what people think of as the desert, where, you know, there's no, you know, virtually little life exists, and it's barren and it's a wasteland. In truth, it's a vibrant, rich, ecological, biodiverse system. It's just uniquely different and specific to those regions.
Exactly.
So that's, you know, kind of comparatively. And I think you lay this out in your book, right? The book On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, and you're really talking about the struggles and your experiences and working with other Indigenous peoples and allies, and, you know, the importance of place, right? Water relations and the web of life, if you and how water sustains that web of life, and how indigenous peoples rely on the web of life for traditional and contemporary forms of cultural practices, such as, you know, fishing, which has always been traditional but has been hampered and reduced because of settler colonial violence. And you mentioned the pipeline and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and you talk quite extensively about the struggle with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline in the chapter of your book titled This is Indian Land. And in the book, you can explain to our listeners what the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is again. But in the book, you mentioned the pipeline would cross more than 300 water bodies, and it would permanently alter or destroy nearly 500 acres of wetlands. And I was wondering if you can speak to that, because that quote just resonates with some of the things we've been discussing about your book.
Yeah, and I won't go into too much detail about the pipeline itself, since right. we've covered it on previous episodes of your program. You know, I'll summarize by saying it was a failed project to bring fracked gas from wells in West Virginia all the way across the Appalachian Mountains down to the eastern seaboard, where most of it would be burned for electricity production in place of coal. That project involved 600 miles of buried, large diameter, high pressure gas pipeline, and it absolutely would have required the excavation and the destruction of a large amount of wetlands, and those wetlands were disproportionately concentrated in places like Lumbee Territory. Right. So, you know, our wetlands are already impacted by a long history of draining and ditching and other kinds of activities, and this would have compounded the problem with a whole new suite of buried pipelines and clear cuts and the accompanying damage to those landscapes. So I spent a lot of time talking about that particular project in the book, because in so many ways it clearly illustrated all the ways that our permitting and regulatory frameworks really serve to erase indigenous peoples from the decision-making table. So we're in many cases not even part of the conversation when it comes to making decisions about whether these projects should be permitted, and if so, where they're going to track across the landscape. And there were just, unfortunately, so many examples of this throughout the lifespan of this project. It made for a very long chapter.
But it's an important chapter in the book because of the work and you know, yourself and others did in resisting the construction of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, really drove up the cost for the quote unquote the stakeholders who are mentioned in several different cases, if you will, in your book, right? Such as Duke Energy and Dominion, for example. But you know, the project ultimately was canceled because of the work and the resistance by indigenous peoples, by yourself, you know, African Americans and other allies. So I think that's an important story that you share with readers in your book. But at the same time, when the project's canceled, you also talk about the role that natural gas has always played in the state, and that these so-called stakeholders, if you will, actually just kind of amplify the problem by creating new natural gas projects. And I was wondering maybe just touch on that, or what can listeners read about and understand and understanding why it's so important that large corporations like Duke Energy, and there's, you know, many others that we've covered on the show, why it's so important to understand who they are, how they operate, and that even when there are these inroads of successes, you know, how their political and economic power results in them just pivoting to a new struggle, which requires even the continuation of this pre-existing work of resisting settler colonial forms of violence.
Yeah, so, you know, for your listeners who may not be familiar with these corporations, these are some of the largest and most powerful corporations in the southeastern United States. You know, huge energy holding companies that own multiple utilities and have billions, if not tens of billions of dollars in revenue each year. And so they basically have unlimited resources to pursue their business priorities, which in North Carolina involve expanding the use of natural gas as a fuel to generate electricity. And of course, this is because these companies are rightly turning away from coal, but instead of leaning more heavily into renewable energy, they're pushing forward with, you know, another fossil fuel that happens to be easier for them to access. Yeah, and so I think what is important for readers to take away from this chapter mm-hmm. is that the injustices and the disparities that we see today with projects like the Atlantic Coast Pipeline or the Dakota Access Pipeline or any of these other projects that come to your audience's mind, it's important to understand that these disparities don't spring out of the ether. They are built on long histories of segregation, of discrimination, and oppression of peoples. And in North Carolina, what that looked like was building an initial network of natural gas pipelines during the 1950s, during the Jim Crow era, during the era before the National Environmental Policy Act, right? And so this was a time when people who were in power could and did place unwanted infrastructure in marginalized communities. And so in recent years, when you ask these companies, you know, why did you choose to put this pipeline in this particular community, the only answer you're likely to get is that this is where the rest of our stuff is. And it's as if nobody's willing to ask the follow-up question, well, why is the rest of your stuff here? We don't want to have these conversations about the historical legacy that's associated with the histories of these projects. We want to act like they've always been cited here. And yeah, we're just putting them here because yeah, this is where we own some other stuff without thinking about why your infrastructure was placed there in the first place.
And you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Ryan Emanuel from the Lumbee Nation, who's also Associate Professor of Hydrology at Duke University. He authored a brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. We are speaking with him for the hour. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. We are
fracking, we must resist. If we don't, the world will cease to exist.
We are here.
With my mind on the seventh generation, succeed when we plant the seeds, knowing that we'll never sit under the shade of the tree. Wisdom we know, live the two row, only get the fruit of the seed that you sow. Still wanna know, where will you go when the water won't flow and the plants won't grow? Really though, how deep is the greed? Got $1 billion now, how much you need? think I tell myself you must not know me. It's in my fist screaming mini with Joni. Not survival, just the dark versus the light. The foundation, water is life. It's not just survival, dark versus light. The foundation, water is life.
The color of our souls is light. Not red, yellow, black or white.
We oh hey.
The song Save the Planet Right Now by Irv Lyons here on American Indian Airwaves. In the second segment of our program, we go back to our interview with Dr. Ryan Emanuel. He is from the Lumbee Nation, a longtime community activist and scholar who's an associate professor of hydrology at Duke University. We're speaking with him on his brand new authored book titled On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. In the book, he shares stories from North Carolina about Indigenous survival and resilience in the face of radical environmental changes. He addresses a wide range of issues, from the loss of wetlands to the arrival of gas pipelines, and how these stories connect the dots between the historical patterns of Indigenous oppression and present-day efforts to promote environmental justice. And now back to the interview with Dr. Ryan Emanuel. Now, would it be the same in the chapter you talk about CAFA facilities or the livestock industry, concentrated animal feed operations in the livestock industry? Is that fair to say they share kind of the same settler colonial genealogical legacy, if you will, as some of these other extractive industries, say like natural gas or the coal industry with these perpetrators like Duke and Dominion?
The processes are a little different between the natural gas pipelines and the concentrated animal feeding operations, but the outcomes are very similar. The power is concentrated with corporations and with individuals who don't come from historically marginalized communities and don't share those lived experiences with us. And so when it comes time to make decisions about, you know, whether we're going to keep these facilities operating as they have been for decades or whether we're going to implement best practices to reduce pollution, people tend not to think about the impacts on indigenous communities or racially minoritized communities because they don't share that lived experience. And so you see corporations pursuing things like, oh, let's tie in these hog waste facilities to our natural gas pipelines, you know, as a way of giving ourselves some negative carbon credit. And really what that's doing is further entrenching polluting infrastructure that people who live near those facilities didn't want in the first place and, you know, hoped that the corporations would do something to abate the waste. But instead, you know, they've entangled it with a completely separate industry. And now, you know, that means it's probably going to be around for much longer than we hoped in the first place. Yeah, but the outcomes are the same. They entrench these patterns of marginalization that were set up decades ago.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Ryan Emanuel of the Lumbee Nation. He's also Associate Professor of Hydrology at Duke University. He has authored a brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. And it's a compendium of different stories of his personal and professional experiences in working with Indigenous peoples and allies throughout what is now called the state of North Carolina. We want to remind listeners that the work that we do here on American Indian Airwaves and KPFK does require your support. And we're asking listeners during our fund drive to financially support KPFK to help us continue to bring diversified, wide range, and unheard Indigenous voices, to appreciate the work that all of us do here as volunteer programmers, as volunteer staff here at KPFK. We're asking you to financially support the station, and there's a variety of ways in which you can do that. You can visit the kpfk.org website, click on the KPFK Fund Drive widget. You can agree to donate a dollar amount of your choice. You can agree to become a KPFK Sustainer Circle member by agreeing to donate a dollar amount on a monthly basis, or there's a list of premium items for a specific dollar amount as a way to say thank you. You can pick up one of those premium items for the dollar amount listed on the kpfk.org website as a way to support the station. You can call 818-985-KPFK, 818-985-5735. If you appreciate what we do here on American Indian Airwaves and all the volunteer programmers, all the volunteer staff in bringing you these invaluable stories and experiences of grassroots people, of activists in fighting against forms of injustice, we ask that you support KPFK. Without you, the listeners, KPFK cannot continue, and therefore we ask that you financially help us here on American Indian Airwaves. Help us here at KPFK. Show your appreciation. Donate a dollar amount. Again, visit the kpfk.org website. Click on the KPFK Fund Drive widget. Donate. Donate a dollar amount on a monthly basis. Look at the premium items. Pick up a premium item of your choice as a way to say thank you. And now we want to go back to our interview with Dr. Ryan Emanuel on his brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, here on American Indian Airwaves. What I love about the chapter, in the book is just really illustrating how corporations have a certain kind of corporate anatomy in how they function, and they're very similar in the kind of violence that gets produced. And I think it gets laid out very clearly. And I think, as listeners know from our prior conversations and in reading the book, right, is how large these industries are that you've written about based on, your lived experiences and in relationship to other people. And I know we want people to pick up and read the book, but you do, towards the end of the book, for our readers, you do provide an uplifting story, right? It's not just all harm, loss, and an intergenerational wounding. And so I know you talk about the Kahari people and really, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, how the work that they're doing in restoring the river is kind of this flagship model of restoration work, certainly not without its complications due to settler colonialism. And then you also end, right, in the book in talking about recommendations and transformation. And so for our listeners, maybe give us a tease of what that looks like or what that sounds like when they read your book.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't want to end the book on a low note because that's not who we are as people, right? Mm, often forget that there's such thing as Indigenous joy. Mm-hmm. And I wanted that to shine through in the book. And when we talk about environmental issues in the place that is now called Eastern North Carolina, one of the shining successes to me is the story of Kahari people and their efforts to restore right relationships with their ancestral river. And that's just a beautiful narrative of overcoming adversity and lots of challenges to create this amazing intergenerational project that gets people on the water, makes people happy, has them reconnect with these beautiful landscapes and waterways, and it's super inspiring. And I wanted to leave folks with that image, because despite all the challenges, it is possible for indigenous peoples and the nations that they belong to kind of rise above and restore relationships with the environment on their own terms. We can't do it in every case, but I firmly believe that where we can do it, we ought to celebrate it and hold it up for the beautiful example and the joyful example that it is. And in terms of recommendations, you know, my experiences working in this space over the past several years have taught me all kinds of lessons, and I wanted to generalize and share some of those recommendations with specific groups of people. I wanted to speak to tribal leaders. I wanted to speak to non-Indigenous people who are in positions where, you know, they may be able to make decisions about environmental policies or permits that affect Indigenous lands and waters. And I also want to speak to individual Indigenous people, you know, who may not be in positions of power or authority, but still have a stake in these landscapes, whether they're North Carolina landscapes or whether they're own traditional lands someplace else. Those were three distinct groups of people that I saw lessons for in all of the stories that are contained in this book. And you and I both know that we're storytelling people, but telling the story is really only part of the process. You know, we have to kind of summarize those lessons for folks as well. And so the end of my book is sort of a summary of the lessons from all of these stories in a way that I hope people will be able to take with them and use wherever it is that they come from or wherever it is that they call sacred or call home.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Dr. Ryan Emanuel on his brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice in the East Side of Turtle Island in North Carolina. And now back to the interview. In talking about storytelling and intergenerationality and just kind of final thoughts as we wrap up here, you know, so much of the work that Indigenous peoples do, you know, yourself and others, rely on standing on the shoulders of previous generations. And while we haven't talked too much about, you know, just you individually and your per se in the sense of I, but I think an important person that connects to this, the comments and the good words you just shared with our listeners, is a person by the name of Miss Rosa Winfrey. And I was wondering, you know, talk about her and her sacrifices and her influence, because it really speaks to this idea of, you know, Indigenous activism and justice, you know, amidst, you know, the injustices and the, you know, constant environmental afflictions that surround us. But it connects to your lived experiences and all those relations that you've developed, cultivated, and connected with over your years and your work and your sacrifices.
Yeah, Ms. Rosa was a Lumbee educator, and you know, we have a long tradition of training educators at all levels in our community. And she's a very special person because she worked with urban Native students like myself, who were in a very large school district and may have been one of, you know, only two or three Native students in their entire school. And she made sure that no matter how far away from our tribal communities we were, that we felt a sense of community and connection, and that we were empowered to find our calling and to follow it. And so while I have many mentors and supporters in my life, I write specifically about her in the conclusion of the book because she touched so many lives through her work as an educator and as a coordinator in our urban Indian education program. And I could go through and point out many people who are doing powerful work today, you know, for their tribe or for other communities, or you know, even on larger stages, who were students of Ms. Rosa. And so I had to acknowledge that powerful persona in the book, and I just wanted to speak to that. And I hope that story resonates with folks as well, because it was a very powerful part of the book for me to write, and also a very emotional part of the book to write and even to reflect on later.
Well, I think for readers too, you know, in reading your book, right, they can see the intergenerationality and how prior generations and their sacrifices and their hard work, you know, created the opportunities or created the foundation, right, for future generations and, you know, for the work that you and others, you know, are doing. And then the work that you and others are doing are, you know, creating or solidifying and expanding that foundation for future generations. And so that wraps up our interview here on American Indian Airwaves. We've been speaking with Dr. Ryan Emanuel on his brand new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, here on American Indian Airwaves. And we want to remind you that we are in fund drive mode. And if you appreciate the work that we do, appreciate the work that KPFK and all its volunteer staff does and volunteer programmers does for you, the listeners, we ask that you support us here on American Indian Airwaves and support KPFK. There are several ways in which you can support the station as we continue to move forward in our transition to a new location and are providing a community service amongst the vast swath of the media. As you know, here KPFK is 100% listener supported, and we rely on all of you, the listeners, to support us here at KPFK. Ways you can support the station: you can become a monthly KPFK sustainer member. You can visit the kpfk.org website, click on the KPFK wedge, and agree to donate a dollar amount of your choice on a monthly basis as a way to show your appreciation and to support KPFK. Also on the KPFK website, you can click on the KPFK pledge widget, and there's a variety of premium items that are listed for a specific dollar amount, and you can pick up one of those premium items for that dollar amount as another way to show your support here on KPFK. You can also call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, and speak with someone to and express your way that you want to support KPFK here on the American Indian Airwaves. Marcus?
Larry, so true. We want to reach out to the listeners. You know, you've been listening to American Indian Airwaves. We go all the way to Lakota country. We go all the way over there with the Mohawks. We go all the way to the East Coast. And the situation with the Oshodani people, and then we go down to Mexico, we report that. We even go Kanaka people, we mentioned Lahaina, you know, and the tragedy what's going on in Maui, you know, we mentioned that. We mentioned also what's going on in the local community. So, you know, I think one important thing, we want to reach out to our Native communities, but also non-Native communities, to donate in this time of need. And at the same time, Larry, no other program, because does what we do, and we want to reach out to all the people that listen and like us to reach out and donate. to KPFK. Now, at the same time, you know this already, Larry. I'm not going to repeat it, but because you do an excellent job. So the transnational capitalist and the media outlays, this what we call the multinational corporation, that situation, and their control of the media and the propaganda and the shamanism and the world politics and shaping the image of United States, you might say, colleagues in imperialism. And we use these words not lightly, but said all the major corporations and the media outlets have an agenda. Our agenda is clear, and that is bring the truth about Native issues and the situation of combating racism, combating, you know, white supremacy, combating, you know, the stranglehold of Native nations and the terrible history of this country, the ethnic cleansing and the genocide and the Holocaust and all those fancy words that basically that terrorizing the Native community. We can have so many other things, but that history needs to be understood to have a vision for the future. American Indian Airways been going on for some time. And I think one of the things, Larry, is that we want to, this time, especially fundraisers, reach out to our communities and saying that your organization, your church group, your reservations within the areas that we touch and whatnot, in order to combat the misinformation on the multinational corporations, you know, like mineral extraction industries and all the government, you know, reports that really side with the multinational corporations and extraction industries, or at the same time, these transnational capitalists that manipulate and also have their own agenda. Our agenda is simple. Bring the truth to you, our listeners. We are offering these pledges. Go on the website, kpfk.org, and we thank you so much for giving your time and your money to listen to our programs, number one, but at the same time, go reach in your wallet, take out that plastic, donate to here to KPFK, and if you support the American Indian Airwaves. Larry.
Thank you, Marcus. And, you know, it's so important to support us and in KPFK, in part because, like what you're saying about transnational capital and private media, which dominates our entertainment media landscape, that dominates, you know, the news media landscape, that dominates the internet. And there's all kinds of different ways that computational propaganda and other media forms of propaganda that exist out there. And indigenous voices, Native American voices and nations, especially, you know, frontline grassroots peoples and even our Native artists, you know, such as the case with our Sacred Sage series, are frequently, you know, erased. They're unheard voices, they're distorted or maligned voices by non-Native people, you know, reporting or talking about Native issues. And here on American Indian Airwaves, we try to, you know, fill that gap. And certainly, you know, a one-hour show doesn't provide us the means to fill that gap, just because of, you know, how vast and how numerous Native American peoples are throughout Turtle Island. But here on American Indian Airwaves, we do bring you those unheard, marginalized, and erased voices of Native peoples on the front lines, doing the grassroots work, right, making inroads in settler colonialism and trying to, you know, dismantle it, if you will, or certainly challenge it in ensuring that we have a future as Indigenous peoples. And that includes all of you, the listeners, supporting Native peoples, supporting the work that we do here on American Indian Airwaves, and supporting KPFK, which allows us to have this base, if you will, a home on the radio airwaves. And so we ask, again, you support the station in a variety of different ways. You can call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or visit the kpfk.org website. You can become a KPFK Sustainer Circle member by agreeing to donate a dollar amount of your choice on a monthly basis, or select from a variety of premium items for that dollar amount as a way to show your support here on American Indian Airwaves and KPFK.
The moment of silence is over.
And that concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest for the hour, Dr. Ryan Emanuel. A special thank you to our musical guests, Aragon Star, Koopa Aina, Irv Lyons, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
Sleep caged against their fear. They're trying not to become what they've endured. Wearing their souls on the thread. The moment of silence is over. And for the innocent, you can't justify why your freedom manifests on their graves. And the blood never comes clean from the guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains. In a rhythm of resistance, we still fight for our lives. In this war that never ended, we've outdrawn your lives. Let our
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with